Section VA-18 of the University of Montana Student Code. Section VA-18 prohibits rape. Reportedly, on February 4, 2012, you raped a fellow student, Ms. Cecilia Washburn, at her off-campus apartment. Upon the conclusion of my investigation, if I have found sufficient evidence that you violated the student conduct code as alleged, I intend to seek your immediate expulsion from the university. As Johnson read the letter, he began to tremble and hyperventilate, according to his housemates, and could hardly speak. Two of these housemates, Alex Bieniemann and Bo Tully, suggested to Johnson that he seek advice from one of their assistant football coaches who lived nearby. He wasn't home, however, so they phoned Robin Flugrad, the head coach, who invited Johnson to come to his home and talk. Flugrad and Johnson are both from Eugene, Oregon, and Flugrad was a friend of Johnson's parents. Flugrad had a son who'd attended Eugene's Sheldon High, where Johnson had gained national attention as an exceptional quarterback. In December 2009, when Johnson was a senior at Sheldon, Flugrad was named head coach at the University of Montana. Almost immediately, Flugrad offered Johnson a scholarship to attend college at UM and play football for the Grizz. Johnson eagerly accepted. When Alex Bieniemann drove Jordan Johnson to Robin Flugrad's house and dropped him off, Johnson was still extremely agitated by Dean Couture's letter. During the hour or so that Johnson spent with Flugrad, he told his coach that the sex with Washburn had been consensual and he absolutely did not rape her. "In that case," Flugrad replied, "Johnson had nothing to worry about, because there was no way he could get in trouble for something he didn't do." The 53-year-old coach assured his 19-year-old quarterback that everything was going to be okay. Immediately after Johnson went home, Flugrad called UM Athletic Director Jim O'Day to alert him that Jordan Johnson was being investigated by Dean Couture for rape, and the UM Athletic Department promptly mobilized to do everything possible to defend Johnson against Cecilia Washburn's allegation. In early March, Cecilia Washburn was traversing the UM campus with a friend when she saw Jordan Johnson, who happened to be walking nearby. Although Johnson made no effort to approach Washburn and apparently never even noticed her, when Washburn caught sight of him, she panicked. It was the first time she had laid eyes on Johnson since the night he'd allegedly raped her. Terrified, she ran inside a nearby building to hide, then called Lori Morin, the assistant dean for student affairs at the UM School of Pharmacy. Morin urged Washburn to come to her office right away. When Washburn arrived, Morin testified, she was sobbing uncontrollably. "She just came and hugged on to me and would not let me go. I've never seen a person so terrified." On March 9th, prompted by this inadvertent encounter, Cecilia Washburn filed a temporary restraining order against Jordan Johnson. It forbade him to threaten or harass her and required him to stay at least 1,500 feet away from her and her home. Reporter Irina Cates learned about the restraining order on March 15th and posted a story about it on KPAX.com at 1:06 a.m. on March 16th under the headline, "Grizz QB Served with Restraining Order After Alleged Sexual Assault." This was the first public revelation that Jordan Johnson had been accused of rape. Although Cecilia Washburn's name was kept out of the reports that immediately appeared in the news media, the rape was no longer a secret. Therefore, she decided that she might as well go ahead and report her assault to the Missoula police. She did this on the afternoon of March 16th. In accordance with the University of Montana Student Athlete Conduct Code, which Johnson had signed, when the Grizz football team commenced its spring practice drills on March 19th, Johnson wasn't allowed to participate. Confronted with the news about their brilliant quarterback, Missoulians reacted with shock and incredulity. On the popular internet forum eGrizz.com, a fan posted, "Last year I took my 2 3-year-old girls to a few of the games, and I was looking forward to trying to make it to all of the games with them this next fall. But now I'm thinking that I'll find something else to do with them this next fall. If even a fraction of what has been alleged is actually true, then the Grizzly program still has a serious problem. It's hard to root for players when you just can't trust that they are decent people. And I surely don't want my girls to grow up admiring these boys when there seems to be such a large collection of creeps in their midst. And I need to hear outrage from the fans, not just a bunch of excuses. This cannot all be the fault of the girls or Gwen Florio or anything else other than the football team. There is no way there is this much out there and not some blame to be had on the part of the football team. And maybe Flugrad didn't create or in any way cause this problem, and likely he never even envisioned it, but if he wants to be the leader of this team, he had better figure out a way to solve it. 13 minutes later, in response, a different Grizz fan posted, "Please don't come to any more games. This is nothing more than a witch hunt." On March 23, 2012, the restraining order against Jordan Johnson was dismissed in lieu of a civil no-contact order, negotiated by Cecilia Washburn's attorney, Josh Van de Wettering. 4 months earlier, Van de Wettering had represented Calvin Smith when Smith was found guilty of raping Caitlin Kelly by the University of Montana, and Johnson's attorney, David Paoli. It placed the same restrictions on Johnson as the restraining order. He was still required to stay 1,500 feet away from Washburn, but because the no-contact order was a civil procedure rather than a criminal procedure, Coach Flugrad and the UM Athletic Department allowed Johnson to practice with the football team, relying on a very lenient interpretation of the student-athlete conduct code. Flugrad told Missoulian reporter Gwen Florio that he was glad Jordan Johnson was back at practice. "I think any time you have a person of Jordy's character and tremendous moral fiber, and he's your team captain and part of the leadership council," Flugrad said, "your players are going to be fired up." Josh Van de Wettering thought Flugrad's effusive endorsement of Jordan Johnson in the Missoulian was highly inappropriate under the circumstances, and that Johnson should not have been allowed to return to the team. In a letter to a UM administrator, Van de Wettering complained that the athletic department's decision to reinstate Mr. Johnson is based at least in part on your misunderstanding of the legal process against Mr. Johnson. On March 29th, a day after Van de Wettering's letter was received, University of Montana President Royce Engstrom fired both Robin Flugrad, who had recently been named the Big Sky Conference Coach of the Year, and UM Athletic Director Jim O'Day. Although Engstrom didn't state a reason for dismissing the two men, Coach Flugrad had come under criticism for his handling of the alleged gang rape of Kelsey Belknap by four Grizz football players in December 2010. In February 2011, Flugrad had learned that these players had been accused of raping Belknap and were being investigated by the Missoula police, but he had neglected to share the information with O'Day, Dean Couture, or any other UM administrators. As a consequence, nobody from the university contacted Kelsey Belknap, and the university failed to initiate a timely investigation of what appeared to be a serious crime. Jordan Johnson's alleged rape of Cecilia Washburn on February 4, 2012, in addition to the other sexual assaults by Grizz football players that occurred on Coach Flugrad's watch, apparently compelled President Engstrom to take decisive action. Missoulians were already disturbed by the escalating rape scandal, and the firing of Robin Flugrad and Jim O'Day left the town reeling. On March 30th, the football team posted a letter on GoGrizz.com, no connection to eGrizz.com, the official website of the UM Athletic Department. "Dear parents, Grizz Nation, the University of Montana, the citizens of Missoula. We write this letter as the players of the 2012 University of Montana football team. We also write this letter as students of a university we love, members of a community we cherish, and as stewards of one of the most respected and honored football traditions of excellence in the nation. The events over the past months regarding allegations and actions of players, and most recently the firing of our head coach and the athletic director, have all had a deep and profound impact on us. We understand and accept the fact that a few of our teammates' actions, whether intended and deserved or not, have contributed to this unfortunate situation. Whether or not true, regardless of obvious motivations and despite the facts or lack of them, we have learned that the rules in today's public arena are about perception and expediency. As student athletes of this university, we are left without an answer as to why our two leaders, Coach Flugrad and Jim O'Day, are gone. These events have left us disappointed, saddened, and stunned, but they have also provided us something else. We have been reminded of the commitment we made years ago, and supported by our families, to pursue excellence in the sport we love that led us from across the country and Montana to come here. Our responsibility to honor those who support us, our duty to respect the players and coaches who built the proud Grizz tradition, and our unwavering appreciation of Grizz Nation is now stronger and more deeply felt. Most importantly, our commitment to each other is stronger than ever. Speaking with one voice, we ask for your strength, support, and solidarity. We hope this series of personal and collective tragedies will give way to strengthening and rebuilding. We also ask those who have been entrusted with authority and power to carefully consider the impact of their statements and actions on our team and our great tradition. Our team stands together, closer and stronger than ever before. Just as we will hold ourselves to a higher standard, we will also hold others. We understand that honor, truth, and hard work win in the end. We are Montana. The letter showed a belated understanding by the Grizz players that Missoula's sexual assault problem was having a deleterious impact on the football program and their individual careers. Conspicuously absent, however, was any expression of concern for the women who had been raped by their teammates. One is left with the sense that the football players saw themselves as the primary victims of the rape scandal. Many Missoulians shared the players' perspective. There is a feeling in Missoula that the Grizzlies football team represents the entire town, not just the University of Montana. Even Missoulians who despise the university for what they perceive to be its liberal bias and academic insularity tend to love the Grizz. At the time, a large segment of the population seemed to feel that the whole city had been unfairly besmirched by the scandal. Expressions of support for the beleaguered team appeared all over Missoula in the form of flags, banners, t-shirts, and signs proclaiming, "We are Grizz Nation." Florio was called a bitch and a cunt by anonymous posters to internet forums, and she was threatened with violent assault. But the support for the football players wasn't universal. Stenciled graffiti declaring, "We are Grizz Rape Nation," with the word Grizz struck through, appeared as well, on a few Missoula walls and railway underpasses. And the bad news about Missoula's rape problem, as it turned out, was far from over. On May 1, 2012, the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, Thomas Perez, arrived in Missoula and held a press conference to announce that the DOJ had launched a major investigation into the handling of 80 Missoula sexual assault cases over the previous 3 years. Perez said the DOJ would be investigating the Missoula County Attorney's Office, the Missoula Police Department, and the University of Montana. Letters sent to County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg and Police Chief Mark Muir alleged that their agency's failure to investigate reports of sexual assaults against women amounted to gender discrimination. Van Valkenburg and Muir appeared beside Perez at the press conference, along with Missoula Mayor John Engen and UM President Royce Engstrom. Although Muir, Engen, and Engstrom promised to support the investigation, Van Valkenburg took the microphone after Perez made his comments and slammed the DOJ. He railed against the heavy hand of the federal government, adamantly denied that his office had done anything wrong, and refused to cooperate with the feds, claiming that the DOJ was overreaching its jurisdiction. Assistant Attorney General Thomas Perez wasn't swayed by Fred Van Valkenburg's outburst. "I don't think protecting women from rape or sexual harassment," he said, "is an overreach of federal government." As the scandal had intensified during the first 6 months of 2012, the Missoula Police Department, the Missoula County Attorney's Office, and the University of Montana had scrambled to address the torrent of negative press, with mixed results. On multiple occasions, public officials became so rattled by media reports about the scandal that they actually tried to blame Gwen Florio and/or rape victims for their predicament. Media inquiries about the university's response to the sexual assaults were handled by UM Vice President of External Relations, Jim Foley. He had a close relationship with the athletic department, and he accompanied the football team to all of its out-of-town games. In March 2012, Foley sent an email to Dean Charles Couture suggesting that the university take disciplinary action against Kelsey Belknap for speaking to Florio about the school's mishandling of her case. Is it not a violation of the student code of conduct for the woman to be publicly talking about the process and providing details about the conclusion? Foley inquired. Foley also took umbrage at Florio's use of the terms gang rape and football players to describe the assault of Belknap in 2010 by four members of the Grizz football team, instead of calling it a date rape by multiple students, as it was characterized in official university statements. Can anybody tell me where UM has used the terms gang rape and football players in any public document that the Missoulian would be referencing? He wrote in an email to Dean Couture, UM Counsel David Aronofsky, and Lucy France, the UM Director of Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action. Couture explained to Foley that he had used the term gang rape when referring to the assault of Kelsey Belknap, because that is what it was. To Couture's credit, in December 2011, a year after the alleged assault occurred, when he learned that Belknap had purportedly been raped by reading about it in the Missoulian, he launched an investigation of Benjamin Styron and the four football players accused of raping her. The university court determined that Styron was not guilty of violating the university's student conduct code. Thanks to Couture's efforts, however, one of Belknap's assailants was expelled. Another agreed to withdraw from the university at the end of the 2012 spring semester, was banned from any future access to the UM campus, and was prohibited from re-enrolling in any Montana University System campus in the future. The other two perpetrators, who dropped out of school after Gwen Florio's article about Kelsey Belknap was published, were notified that they would face disciplinary action if they ever attempted to re-enroll. Chapter 13. Following the arrest of Bo Donaldson on January 6, 2012, for raping Allison Huguette, he remained in jail until January 13th, when he was released on bail, which had been reduced from $100,000 to $50,000. That same day, Huguette got an alarming phone call from a close friend who had attended high school with her and Donaldson. This friend told Huguette that an admirer of Donaldson's named Sharon Mortimer, pseudonym, had been telling people that Huguette was lying when she accused Donaldson of raping her, and that Donaldson had also been falsely accused of raping another woman in 2008. The rumor made Huguette wonder. Sharon Mortimer was obviously wrong about Bo Donaldson being innocent of raping her. Maybe Mortimer was also wrong about Donaldson being innocent of raping this other woman, whoever she was. So Huguette phoned Detective Guy Baker, the officer who'd arrested Donaldson, to let him know about the rumor. Detective Baker tracked down Sharon Mortimer and asked her to come to the Missoula Police Department to be interviewed. If Bo Donaldson had indeed raped another woman 2 years before raping Allison Huguette, then the victim could be persuaded to testify against Donaldson. It could help convict him for raping Huguette, even if this other victim hadn't reported the assault to the police. As David Lisak has noted, persuading a jury to convict a serial rapist is a lot easier than convicting someone who's under suspicion for committing only a single rape. During her interview with Detective Baker, Sharon Mortimer explained that she had a second cousin named Hillary McLaughlin who lived in Great Falls. In the autumn of 2008, McLaughlin came to Missoula on a Friday night to visit her best friend, Joanna Sutherland, pseudonym, who had gotten McLaughlin a ticket to a Grizz football game on Saturday. The night before the game, Sutherland held a party at her house, and McLaughlin invited Mortimer to come over and join the fun. Mortimer showed up with her boyfriend and Bo Donaldson, who was a freshman at UM that fall. Sharon Mortimer told Detective Baker that Hillary McLaughlin was attracted to Donaldson, wanted to hook up with him, and led him upstairs to show him something in Joanna Sutherland's bedroom. The following evening, Sharon Mortimer told Detective Baker she got a phone call from one of Hillary McLaughlin's friends, who was upset about what Bo had done to Hillary. In a subsequent conversation with McLaughlin, according to Mortimer, McLaughlin told her that while McLaughlin and Donaldson were upstairs, he had tried to rape her, but Mortimer didn't believe it. She reported to Detective Baker that when she, her boyfriend, and Donaldson had left the party, McLaughlin had hugged her, said goodbye to Donaldson, and given no indication that anything was wrong. Hillary McLaughlin had invented the story about the attempted rape because she had consensual sex with Bo Donaldson and then regretted it, Mortimer insisted. A week after interviewing Sharon Mortimer, Detective Baker interviewed Hillary McLaughlin, and McLaughlin's account of what happened at Sutherland's party was rather different from Mortimer's. As McLaughlin told Detective Baker, and later told me, Beau Donaldson began hitting on McLaughlin as soon as he arrived at the party. "Beau was very, very clingy," McLaughlin recalled, "and kind of hung all over me for the entire night. I had never met him before, so it was kind of weird." It was also strange that Donaldson, as a member of the Grizz football team, was drinking heavily the night before a game. Hillary McLaughlin had arrived in Missoula that evening after working all day and then driving 3 hours from Great Falls. After spending a couple of hours with Beau Donaldson, she felt worn out, so she left the party and went upstairs alone to get ready for bed. When she arrived in Joanna Sutherland's room, McLaughlin took off her makeup, changed into a t-shirt and sweatpants, and climbed into bed. "I was playing on my phone and laying in bed," McLaughlin said, "and for some reason I still had the light on. All of a sudden the door opened and it was Beau. And he walks in and doesn't say anything, and then he shuts the door and locks it. Donaldson didn't turn off the light, and McLaughlin vividly remembers what happened next. He had khaki shorts on, and he pulls them down and he gets on top of me. Donaldson was drunk, she told me, but I don't think he was to the point where he couldn't control himself. As Beau Donaldson sprawled over her, essentially naked from the waist down, McLaughlin wrapped the sheets around herself as tightly as possible. He pushed her phone onto the floor and began humping his penis against her, pinning her body to the mattress. "I started screaming," McLaughlin said, "because he was just kind of grinding on top of me and trying to make out with me. I was moving my head to keep him from kissing me and screaming." Around midnight, Joanna Sutherland was sitting on the staircase with two friends, a man named Cody, pseudonym, and a woman named Grace, pseudonym, and heard the screaming. They rushed up to Sutherland's bedroom but discovered that the door was locked. For several minutes, the three of them tried to open the door without success, and as they struggled with the lock, the crying and screaming from inside the room continued. When McLaughlin heard her friends trying to force their way into the bedroom, she yelled, "Joanna, help me!" They yelled back, "We're trying to get the door open!" All the while, Beau Donaldson kept humping McLaughlin, despite her cries for help and the yelling from just beyond the door. After maybe 5 to 8 minutes, Hillary McLaughlin recalled, I think Cody finally broke the hinge off the door and got it open. "I was still screaming, and Beau was still grinding on me and wouldn't stop and wouldn't get off of me. I was like, 'What are you doing? Leave me alone!' Finally, I believe either Cody or Grace just ripped him right off of me. He still had his shorts down, and they pushed him out of the room." When he interviewed Grace about the incident, Detective Baker wrote in his case report, Grace said Donaldson acted as if he was irritated that they had interrupted what he was doing with Hillary. According to the case report, Joanna Sutherland told Detective Baker that, based on what she observed when she opened the locked door, she felt, if nobody stopped him, he would have raped Hillary McLaughlin. Baker wrote that, Joanna stated it was obvious Hillary did not want to be with him, but Beau did not stop despite Hillary's continued screams and Joanna and Grace's attempts to get the door unlocked. After Joanna, Grace, and Cody got Donaldson out of the bedroom, McLaughlin told me, I remember I just sat there and cried. I didn't know what to think. I'd never been in a situation like that before. Sutherland and Grace tried to console McLaughlin, who was extremely shaken, and then went downstairs and demanded that Beau Donaldson, Sharon Mortimer, and their friends get out of Sutherland's house immediately. Grace told Detective Baker that Donaldson and his entourage were mad about being asked to leave. The day after the party, Sharon Mortimer returned to Joanna Sutherland's home, apparently unaware that Beau Donaldson had attempted to rape Hillary McLaughlin in Sutherland's bedroom. So McLaughlin took her cousin into a closet so they could talk privately and told her straight up, Beau tried to rape me last night. According to McLaughlin, Mortimer replied, No, he didn't. McLaughlin said, Yes, he did. At which point, Hillary McLaughlin told me, Mortimer again declared, No, he didn't, and became angry. That's bullshit, Mortimer claimed. Beau would never do that. He's not that type of person. To convince her cousin that Beau Donaldson really did try to rape her, McLaughlin gave her a blow-by-blow account of what had gone down in the bedroom. Mortimer refused to believe it, telling McLaughlin, "That's not true, that's not what happened," before leaving Sutherland's house in a huff. When Hillary McLaughlin returned home to Great Falls, she didn't tell anybody except one friend about Beau Donaldson's attempt to rape her, and she decided not to report the assault to the police. This assault happened in 2008. McLaughlin was 19 years old. She'd recently enlisted in the Air National Guard and was about to begin basic training. Although she was traumatized by Donaldson's violent act, she wondered, like so many other victims of sexual assault, whether she was somehow responsible. "I was feeling all these different emotions," McLaughlin remembered. "I couldn't help wondering, like, did I do something to make him think that's what I wanted? Did I drink too much?" "I hadn't really done either of those things, but that stuff goes through your mind anyway. When I thought about it, I knew what happened wasn't my fault, but I didn't want to report it. I was like, I can probably just move past this and forget about it." So that's what she decided to do, and as time went on, it seemed like she had succeeded in putting the assault behind her. In January 2012, Hillary McLaughlin realized that she was mistaken. More than 3 years had passed since Beau Donaldson had attacked her. In the interim, she'd met a man in the Air National Guard and had gotten married. She was 8 months pregnant with their first child. "One evening," McLaughlin told me, "my husband Robert, pseudonym, and I were sitting on the couch when all of a sudden Beau Donaldson's name and picture appeared on the TV screen. I took a deep breath and was like, 'Oh my gosh.' Robert asked, 'What's wrong?' I said, 'I have to tell you something.'" Until that moment, Hillary McLaughlin hadn't said a word about the assault to anyone in her family, and she continued to say nothing about it to any of her relatives beyond her husband. After Beau Donaldson's arrest was in the news, she and Joanna Sutherland talked about it over the phone, Hillary says, "but then we kind of went on with our lives, and I didn't think much about it for a little while." 3 weeks after Donaldson's arrest, however, her husband's phone rang, and an unfamiliar voice on the other end said, "Hi, this is Detective Guy Baker from the Missoula Police Department, and I'm looking for Hillary McLaughlin." My husband wondered, "Why do the police want to talk to Hillary? What kind of trouble is she in?" Hillary said. But I knew immediately why Detective Baker had called. I knew it was about Beau. When Hillary McLaughlin called Baker back, he explained that he'd heard she'd been sexually assaulted by Beau Donaldson in 2008, and he hoped she would be willing to provide him with a recorded statement of what happened that night. McLaughlin wasn't sure she wanted to revisit what had been such a disturbing event. "My brother-in-law at the time was a U.S. Marshal," she said. "So I asked him, 'What should I do?' He goes, 'I think you know what to do. You need to do the right thing.'" After this conversation, McLaughlin was inclined to let Detective Baker interview her, but first she wanted to tell her father about the assault and get his opinion. "I'm very close to my dad," she explained, "and I really wanted to tell him face to face, but I was supposed to do the recording the next day, so I had to tell him over the phone. When I called him, of course, his first instinct was, 'I'm going to kill Beau Donaldson. I'm going to drive down to Missoula and I'm going to kill him.' But then my dad calmed down and said, 'I think you need to make that statement to the police, and you need to do it right away, because it might help that other woman he raped, and it might keep him from raping anyone else.'" On January 26, 2012, Hillary McLaughlin told her story to Detective Baker, and then she waited anxiously for whatever was going to happen next. What happened was that she had an epiphany. She suddenly understood that she'd been deceiving herself when she thought she'd put the attack behind her. In fact, Beau Donaldson was still just beneath the surface of her consciousness, creating all kinds of havoc, and he'd been lurking there ever since he'd tried to rape her. "Before Beau attacked me," McLaughlin said, "I'd never been an anxious person. But around the time he was arrested, I realized that since 2008, there had been a huge spike in my anxiety level. I used to be a very active runner and loved running outside. Now I'm afraid to run outside by myself." "Indeed," she said, "ever since the attack, she's been terrified to be alone." Whenever she was by herself and had to walk from her house to her car at night, she would call her husband, Robert, and ask him to keep talking to her until she was safely inside the vehicle with the doors locked. "He did it," McLaughlin said, "but he never understood why I was so scared." Hesitantly, Hillary McLaughlin admitted that she was also afraid of the dark. "I was 21 years old and afraid of the dark," she said, looking astonished. "It got to the point where I wouldn't even stay at my house by myself. If Robert was out of town for training or something, I would stay at my sister's or my parents. And it's not like I live in a scary neighborhood. I live in a nice, safe neighborhood." McLaughlin recalled a trip she and Robert made to New York. "We were walking down the street to get tickets for a Broadway show," she said, "when a guy just kind of brushed my shoulder, and I lost it. I started crying uncontrollably. I was clutching Robert's hand for dear life." Things got so bad that Hillary finally told her obstetrician about her irrational fears. "I didn't explain to her what happened," she said. "I just said I had severe anxiety. I told her that I bolt, that I'm always scared, always looking over my shoulder. I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and I turn on every light in my house. If I hear one little noise, I completely freak out." McLaughlin said, "I never put it all together until after Beau was arrested. My husband and I were talking one night, and I told him, 'My anxiety has gotten so bad.' He asked me when it began, so we started going back through events to try and figure it out. And that's when I realized. Ever since that night in Missoula is when it began." Chapter 14. On January 13, 2012, the day Beau Donaldson made bail and was released from the Missoula County Detention Facility, Allison Huguet received an email from a deputy county attorney named Sean Donovan, informing her that he would be handling the Donaldson prosecution. Donovan explained that according to the terms of Donaldson's release from the county lockup, he would be required to wear a GPS monitoring device on his ankle and complete a chemical dependency program. Donaldson was also forbidden to have any contact with Huguet or her family, to go within 1,000 feet of her home, or to leave Missoula County. 60 years old, heavy-set and rumpled, Sean Donovan was a native Montanan with an undergraduate degree from Stanford and a Juris Doctor from the University of Montana School of Law. Early in his career, he'd worked for Milt Dotsopoulos, the attorney now representing Donaldson. From 1979 through 2010, Donovan had served as the county attorney in sparsely populated Mineral County, just west of Missoula. As the only lawyer in the office, he personally handled every case. In 2011, when the citizens of Mineral County decided, after 31 years, that it was time for a change and voted him out of a job, Donovan moved back to Missoula, where he became one of 16 deputy attorneys toiling under County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg, in what, by Montana standards, amounted to a large, frenetic law office. Because Beau Donaldson had confessed to raping Huguet while she slept, it would be all but impossible for Milt Dotsopoulos to convince a jury that he was innocent. Sean Donovan was therefore confident that the case would be resolved with a plea deal and would never go to trial. Soon after Donaldson's arrest, however, Dotsopoulos made it clear that he intended to demand a lenient punishment for Donaldson as part of any plea agreement. Huguet, on the other hand, insisted that prosecutors settle for nothing less than a lengthy sentence at the state penitentiary in Deer Lodge. In Montana, a plea deal that involves a negotiated sentence typically works like this. In return for a guilty plea from the defendant, the prosecutors recommend a sentence that the defendant and his attorneys are willing to accept as the maximum punishment. The defendant's attorneys recommend a sentence that the prosecutors are willing to accept as the minimum punishment, and both sides agree to let the judge determine a sentence that falls somewhere within the range of their differing recommendations. After the terms of the plea deal are agreed upon and submitted to the judge, a sentencing hearing is held to allow each side to argue the merits of its recommendation in court. At the conclusion of this hearing, the judge issues a ruling and the sentence is imposed. In Beau Donaldson's case, the plea negotiations, like most plea negotiations, resembled a slow-moving game of chicken. Each side threatened to halt negotiations and take the case to trial, an outcome desired by neither the defense nor the prosecution, unless the other side agreed to its terms. But as the case crept forward through the winter, spring, and summer of 2012, Allison Hugett became increasingly concerned that Sean Donovan wasn't firmly committed to a deal that included hard time at Deer Lodge. Despite Donovan's many assurances to the contrary, Hugett and her family worried that he would cede to Milt Dutsopolis's demands that Bo Donaldson be allowed to serve a short sentence at a minimum security Department of Corrections facility, followed by probation, rather than being incarcerated at the state prison, a much harsher and more restrictive environment. According to Montana state law, the maximum sentence for a person convicted of sexual intercourse without consent, SIWOC, the legal term for rape in Montana, is incarceration in the state prison for 100 years. The minimum sentence is 2 years in the state prison. But the law allows for exceptions to the minimum. In Donaldson's case, for example, if the judge determined that no serious bodily injury was inflicted on the victim, the minimum sentence could include no prison time at all. Indeed, in Missoula County, it was common for defendants found guilty of rape to receive sentences that didn't require them to spend any time behind bars. On April 12th, to give Allison Hugett a better sense of what sort of punishment she might realistically expect Bo Donaldson and his attorney to accept in a plea deal, Sean Donovan sent an email to Allison and her parents, Kevin and Beth Hugett, summarizing the outcome of local rape cases over the previous decade. From 2001 through the first 3 months of 2012, 67 men had been convicted of SIWOC in Missoula County. In 4 of those cases, the defendants were sentenced to an average of 50 years behind bars. In 42 cases, the defendants were sentenced to a mix of prison time and probation that ranged from 10 years to 60 years of prison and probation combined. In the other 21 cases, the sentences included no incarceration whatsoever. At the conclusion of this email, Donovan assured the Hugetts, "I remain committed to seeking a sentence that requires Bo to do some time at the state prison, to be on probation for a very long time after his release, and to register as a sex offender for the remainder of his life. Please let me know if you have any questions, want to talk, or whatever." 27 minutes after she received Sean Donovan's email, Allison wrote back, "For me, it is unsettling knowing that there is even a possibility that he will get no jail time, or even a small amount of time, even though he has confessed to such a horrible crime. I also trust that you know, and hopefully the judge will know, how deeply this has affected me and my family, and understand that Bo has to be the one to pay for it." On April 18th, 2 weeks before Assistant Attorney General Thomas Perez announced that the U.S. Department of Justice was investigating the Missoula County Attorney's Office and the Missoula Police Department for bungling dozens of rape cases, Allison Hugett was contacted by a DOJ investigator who wanted to speak with her about the way the Missoula police and prosecutors had handled her case. When Hugett asked Sean Donovan about the federal investigation, it turned out that neither he nor Fred Van Valkenburg was aware of it. By contacting Donovan, Hugett inadvertently tipped off the county attorney's office that it was under investigation by the DOJ, a revelation that alarmed Van Valkenburg greatly and immediately caused his entire office to circle the wagons. Professing that the county attorney didn't want to complicate the resolution of the case against Bo Donaldson, Donovan asked Hugett to check with him before providing any information to anyone about the Donaldson case. In truth, Van Valkenburg had simply decided that the best way to handle the crisis was to assert that the investigation was an abuse of the DOJ's statutory and constitutional authority and to stonewall the feds. Allison Hugett agreed to contact Sean Donovan before talking to the DOJ, but she said it seemed to her that the investigation might be good for her case and that the added pressure will help everyone. Donovan's response was curt. He reiterated that if anyone from the DOJ contacted her again, "Before you talk to them, we have asked that they call me or Fred Van Valkenburg. Anything you say may get to Bo's lawyer, which is why we want to proceed truthfully but carefully. The added pressure from the investigation may do some good somewhere, but it will not help our case against Bo in any way. It is much more likely to cause harm." Allison Huguet graduated from Eastern Oregon University on June 16, 2012, and returned to Missoula a day later to live at her mother's house and help with the wedding of her older sister Sarah, who was getting married on June 27th. Allison, her younger sister Kathleen, and various friends held a bridal shower for Sarah on June 26th, then went out on the town for a bachelorette party. They had originally intended to go bowling, because Allison had seen some of the ugly comments that had been posted about her online in the wake of Beau Donaldson's arrest, and didn't want to go to a bar, lest she run into some of his friends. But their plans changed, and late that night, Kathleen, Allison, Sarah, and the rest of the bride's entourage ended up at a notorious Missoula drinking establishment called Stockman's. "It's a big grizz bar," Allison told me. "A lot of Beau's friends work there." A mural covering the lower half of Stockman's front window depicts four grizzly bears and a half-dozen Grizz football players sprinting en masse toward the end zone. When Kathleen and Sarah Huguet went to the bar to order drinks, the bartender recognized them as Allison's sisters and refused to serve them. Sarah Huguet and the bachelorettes were sitting opposite the bar, pondering their next move, when a group of men approached. One of them was a brother of Beau's, Brady Donaldson, who was 3 years older than Allison and Beau, and had attended school with Sarah Huguet when they were growing up in the Target Range neighborhood. "They were standing pretty close, just staring at us," Allison remembered. "There was definitely tension in the air." Among the members of Brady Donaldson's retinue was Sam Ursler. Although Ursler was a close friend of the Donaldson brothers, Allison also considered him to be her friend. Ursler had facilitated Beau's confession the morning after he'd raped Allison and had offered her emotional support. So Allison was surprised when an acquaintance named Norman, pseudonym, came over to the bachelorettes and, by her account, said, "God, I can't stand Ursler. I was just over there getting a drink and he told me I need to stay away from you. He said you girls were nothing but trouble." By now, the Huguets and their friends had decided to leave Stockman's. As they were moving out of the bar, Allison said, "I walked past Sam Ursler, touched his arm, and said, 'You know, Sam, I don't badmouth you to other people, and I'd appreciate it if you would do the same for me.' 'What are you talking about?' Ursler replied. 'I've never said anything bad about you.' 'Seriously?' Allison said. 'Did you not just tell Norman that he needed to stay away from me?' This caused Sam Ursler to fly into a rage. 'I never said anything bad about you,' he screamed. As Allison walked away, he followed her out the door, shouting insults at the top of his lungs. 'You fucking bitch,' Ursler yelled. 'I never said anything bad about you.' Then Brady Donaldson started harassing the Huguet sisters as well. 'You may think everything's fine right now,' he shouted at them, "but you guys just wait. In September, when this goes to trial, the gloves are going to come off.' 'Yeah,' Kathleen Huguet spat back. 'In September, when your brother goes to prison and gets fucked in the ass and learns what it feels like to get raped himself.'" By this time, a large crowd had gathered on the sidewalk around the bachelorettes and Brady Donaldson's friends. Donaldson started making threatening gestures, and he bellowed at Allison and Kathleen Huguet, "You need to get the fuck out of Missoula." Someone else in Brady Donaldson's group threatened to kill the Huguets. Ursler screeched at Allison, "Good luck on the fucking stand, bitch." As the Huguets and their friends walked away, Allison recalled, "We could hear them screaming at us for blocks. I felt really bad that it ruined my sister's bachelorette party." Little progress was made on the plea negotiations between the Missoula County Attorney's Office and Milt Dotsopoulos, Beau Donaldson's attorney, through mid-July 2012. On July 20th, Deputy Prosecutor Sean Donovan met with Kevin Huguet to give him an update. 3 days earlier, during a conference with head Missoula County Prosecutor Fred Van Valkenburg and Dotsopoulos, Donovan had floated the idea of recommending a sentence of 5 years and allowing Beau Donaldson to serve it at a minimum security Department of Corrections facility rather than the state prison. Donovan insinuated to Kevin that both Van Valkenburg and Dotsopoulos thought it was a fair sentence. Anticipating that Kevin Huguet might not be thrilled with such a light sentence, Donovan explained that although it was a more lenient sentence than the Huguets wanted, He thought it might be the stiffest punishment Beau Donaldson would accept in return for pleading guilty. Furthermore, if they failed to achieve a plea deal and the case went to trial, a sentence of 5 years at the DOC or even less might well be the outcome, because Milt Datsopoulos was a skilled criminal attorney with a long history of winning rape cases. Sean Donovan pointed out to the Hugetts that Datsopoulos would tell the judge and jury that Beau Donaldson had no prior criminal record. He didn't use a weapon or act violently during the commission of the crime. He was a young man with a promising future. He had a supportive family. He accepted responsibility for his actions, and he would seek treatment for his substance abuse problems and his aberrant sexual behavior. It was understood that if the case went to trial, Datsopoulos was likely to do everything possible to impugn Allison Hugett's character, because smearing the victim is one of the most effective tactics lawyers have at their disposal when defending rapists. Donovan also reminded Kevin Hugett that they needed to consider the environment in Missoula. What he meant by this needed no elaboration. Beau had been a celebrated and beloved hometown high school football star who now played for the Grizzlies. The Grizz were heading into the 2012 season as the reigning co-champions of the Big Sky Conference, and any jury impaneled in Missoula County would almost certainly include a significant number of loyal Grizz supporters. Sean Donovan's rationale for recommending a lenient punishment didn't sit well with Kevin Hugett. He was furious that Donovan would even consider agreeing to a sentence of 5 years at a DOC facility. "We had been fighting Sean for months about this very point. We wanted Beau to serve his time at Deer Lodge, not the DOC, where things would be easy for him, his family could visit whenever they wanted, and where all his buddies could come out and hang with him," Kevin explained. "We knew that if he was sentenced to the DOC, he'd get probation and be out on the street in no time, because that's how it usually works. So we were really adamant that we weren't going to accept anything less than hard time at the penitentiary, and we weren't going to back down from that." When Kevin Hugett told Allison that Sean Donovan had argued for a light sentence at their meeting, she was demoralized. Given the ongoing investigation of the Missoula County Attorney's Office by the DOJ, and all the criticism from both local and national news media that Fred Van Valkenburg's office had allowed numerous rapists to avoid prosecution, she couldn't understand why Donovan and Van Valkenburg seemed so determined to go easy on Beau Donaldson. Detective Guy Baker had told her that the case he'd assembled against Donaldson was backed up with some of the strongest evidence he'd ever submitted for a rape case. With Hillary McLaughlin's testimony about Donaldson's attempt to rape her, the case had grown even stronger. So why was the prosecution so reluctant to seek an appropriately harsh sentence? Allison was shocked that Donovan seemed to be on the verge of reneging on his pledge to settle for nothing less than significant time in the state penitentiary. "It felt like I'd been lied to," she told me, "and pushed in the direction they wanted to go. I felt like I continually had to push back to try to get the prosecutor's office to do the right thing. They made it pretty clear that they didn't like it when I spoke up or questioned what they were doing or asked them to do more than they wanted to. It was really hard for me. I see now why most girls who've been raped don't go forward with pressing charges." Recent sexual assault cases in fanatical football towns such as Tallahassee, Florida, South Bend, Indiana, Seattle, Washington, and Columbia, Missouri, give credence to the notion that if the defendants are star players, it can be difficult to hold them accountable. But to the Hugett family, Sean Donovan's suggestion that it was unrealistic to expect much, if any, prison time for Beau Donaldson because Missoulians were enthralled to Grizz football seemed like a self-fulfilling prophecy. "Sean is a likable guy," Kevin noted, "but he's part of the local good old boys club, and he has two sons who played football for Carroll College, a private school in Helena, Montana, that won the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics football title in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2007, and 2010. I was highly concerned right away that his kids played on teams that won national championships. I wondered where his loyalty was going to lie. How hard is he going to fight for my kid against an accused football player?" Sean seemed way too concerned about the effect of the legal proceedings on Beau and his family. Even in our first meeting, he was talking about Beau's poor family. "Remember that they're victims as well. Beau's actions have caused them significant financial harm and emotional harm. Like, he thinks I care about that? After what Beau did to Allison? He raped my daughter while she was sleeping. I care about only one thing, and that's justice. I want him to go to prison. During their July 20th meeting, Deputy Prosecutor Sean Donovan had given Kevin Huguette a 4-page document that outlined potential sentences for Bo Donaldson and listed the pros and cons of recommending each sentence. Shortly after the meeting concluded, he emailed the same document to Allison, and he also invited her to meet with him to discuss potential sentences. When she read it, her mistrust of Donovan grew. Allison Huguette arranged to meet Donovan on July 26th, and she asked her sister Kathleen and Detective Guy Baker to accompany her. The discussion quickly turned to whether Allison would agree to a 5-year sentence at a minimum security Department of Corrections facility, which Donovan seemed to favor. When Allison told him she would go to trial before she accepted such a lenient punishment for Bo Donaldson, Sean Donovan countered that getting a conviction for rape was, throughout the country, among the most difficult challenges prosecutors faced. Donovan also warned Allison that she might believe she was strong, but being on the witness stand and getting ripped to shreds by a veteran defense attorney like Milt Tsopoulos is a lot harder than you think. Prior to this meeting, however, Detective Baker had assured Allison, "You have the fortitude to go to trial. I know you can do this. I will be there in the courtroom when you're testifying, and you can look over at me for support. Standing up to Bo and telling the truth for everyone to hear will give you back control. It will empower you." Emboldened by Baker's confidence in her, Allison demanded to know why Sean Donovan would even discuss the possibility of a short sentence at the DOC if he was sincerely committed to a longer sentence at the Deer Lodge Penitentiary. Growing angry and defensive, Donovan snapped, "I've been doing this job for a long time, and you're not going to change how I do my job, Allison." Detective Baker broke into the discussion at this point to try to dial down the tension. He politely asked Donovan if he would be willing to explain to Milt Tsopoulos that Allison was unwilling to accept anything less than a sentence in the state penitentiary. According to Allison, Donovan replied, "I would never do that. I will not recommend a sentence simply because it's what the victim wants." This infuriated Allison, but according to the laws of Montana, and almost every other state, although prosecutors are required to consult with victims of rape about plea negotiations, they are completely free to ignore a victim's entreaties at their discretion. A rape victim has absolutely no right to veto a plea deal if he or she finds it objectionable. It came as a surprise to Allison Huguette, but Deputy Prosecutor Sean Donovan was not acting as her attorney in the way that Milt Tsopoulos was acting as Bo Donaldson's attorney. Donovan's title was Deputy Missoula County Attorney, and his legal responsibility was to represent the interests of the state of Montana, not Allison Huguette's interests. Whenever he believed those interests diverged, Huguette was out of luck. As this became clear to Huguette, her anger was exacerbated by the fact that earlier, when she'd asked Donovan if it would be a good idea for her to retain a lawyer to represent her personal interests, he'd repeatedly discouraged her from doing so, assuring her that it was unnecessary and might make her case harder to prosecute. Chapter 15. For the first 16 months after she was raped, Allison Huguette found it surprisingly easy to keep her emotions under control, at least most of the time, by stuffing the trauma into some deep recess of her subconscious. That changed after Bo Donaldson's arrest. Suddenly, her rape was all over the news, and it stayed in the news for months. Missoula can feel like a very small town in which everyone seems to know everyone else's business. Although she was never named by the mainstream news media, hundreds of people, perhaps thousands, learned from the gossip mill that Huguette was Donaldson's accuser, the woman responsible for his arrest. "I was surprised how quickly people found out," said Huguette's friend Keeley Williams, "because the day after Bo got arrested, people started texting me things like, 'What the fuck is wrong with you and Allison? Why is she lying about being raped?'" Donaldson told his friends and family that he and Huguette had had sex multiple times before, so he couldn't have raped her. In turn, his friends and family spread the word throughout Missoula and beyond that she had falsely accused him. A great many people were led to believe that she was enjoying the attention she was getting for maliciously destroying his life. The rumors were utterly false. In the summer of 2012, Huguette grew increasingly anxious, even paranoid, an after effect of the rape. If she entered a bathroom and the shower curtain wasn't pulled all the way open, she became fearful that someone was hiding behind it and she'd panic. Before going to sleep, she would check under the bed to make sure nobody was hiding beneath it. And then she would check again and again. She had great difficulty sleeping. When a doctor recommended that she take medications to reduce her anxiety or help her sleep, she refused. "I didn't want to take something that made me fall asleep," Hugot explained, "because I was afraid I would be unable to wake up if something bad happened." When she did fall asleep, moreover, she had recurring nightmares. "They started after Beau was arrested," Hugot told me, "when I was constantly having to fight the prosecutors about getting him sent to prison. I remember some of the nightmares really clearly." In one of them, Hugot dreamed that she, Beau Donaldson, and her friend Keeley Williams were standing on the McClay Bridge, a decrepit one-lane bridge across the Bitterroot River, in the neighborhood where they grew up. During the summer, the bridge is a popular hangout for local teenagers, who jump from it into the chilly river below. In Hugot's nightmare, she recalled, "It was late fall, or maybe winter. Beau and Keeley and me were down by the bridge, and I think Beau was trying to tell me he was sorry for raping me. And then he jumped off the bridge to kill himself. I jumped in to save him, even though Keeley was yelling, 'No, no, no, let him go. Don't go after him.' I swam over to him and was trying to pull him to shore when suddenly he woke up with this look on his face," Hugot said, trying not to sob. "It was that same look he had when I saw him at the Mo Club at Thanksgiving, and he was laughing at me. I realized that he wasn't drowning and that he hadn't jumped off the bridge to kill himself. Then Beau grabbed me, held me underwater, and tried to drown me." At this point, Hugot woke up, terrified. "Looking at the nightmare now," she continued, "I think it says a lot about what I was going through. I think I was struggling with the fact that I still wanted to trust Beau, my childhood friend, but he obviously was not trustworthy." She had many such nightmares. "When I'd have a dream like that," Hugot said, "I'd wake up emotionally drained. The images from the dream would be really vivid, and they would stay in my head throughout the day. I couldn't get them out of my mind. People don't understand how exhausting that was. The nightmares and not sleeping and constantly worrying about who might be hiding behind the shower curtain. They just don't get what you go through day after day when you've been raped." Allison Hugot's ongoing stalemate with Deputy Prosecutor Sean Donovan and the Missoula County Attorney's Office, MCAO, exacerbated her post-traumatic stress, but she refused to agree to a plea deal that didn't require Beau Donaldson to serve time in the state penitentiary. By late August, Donovan felt he'd negotiated a deal with Donaldson's attorney, Milt Datsopoulos, that the Hugot family would be able to live with. On August 20th, Donovan held a meeting with Allison, her parents, Fred Van Valkenburg, and Assistant Deputy Chief County Attorney Susie Boylan, one of the most skilled prosecutors at the MCAO, to discuss the plea agreement Donovan had drafted, hoping the Hugots would agree to it. The meeting was quarrelsome. According to the terms of the deal, in return for a guilty plea by Donaldson, the state agrees to recommend that the defendant be sentenced to a term of 30 years at the Montana State Prison, with 20 years of that sentence suspended. When the prosecutors asked Allison if she would agree to it, she told them she was not willing to agree to that at all. Boylan tried to change Allison's mind by arguing that 10 years in the state prison was quite harsh. The Hugots responded by pointing out that a 10-year sentence meant Donaldson would in fact be eligible for parole after just 2.5 years. Boylan countered that although Allison appeared to be a very strong woman, she had no idea what it was like to get up on the witness stand and be cross-examined by a ruthless defense attorney. Boylan had seen it many times, she said, and it was almost always an unimaginably horrible experience for the victim. She also stated, quite accurately, that if the case went to trial, there was a good chance that Beau Donaldson would receive a sentence that included no prison time whatsoever. After Boylan spoke, Van Valkenburg told the Hugots that this was almost certainly the harshest deal Milt Datsopoulos and Beau Donaldson would accept, and furthermore that he was going to present the deal to Datsopoulos regardless of whether the Hugots were on board. And if they didn't agree with the terms of the deal, Van Valkenburg added, He hoped that they would at least agree not to let it become a public spat in the media. The next day, August 21st, Sean Donovan sent the plea agreement to Donaldson and Datsopoulos to be signed. On September 11th, 2012, they signed it. That afternoon, television reporter Irina Cates posted a story on the KPAX website in which she wrote, "Prosecutors say the victim is not completely satisfied with the plea bargain, but she understands